The text of the evening is found in Daniel chapter 4, reading the first 26 verses. Daniel chapter 4, 1 through 26. You know, the story is told of a father who took his young son on a walk, and as they walked, they come to a high place and could look out over the countryside. And the father made a comment to his young son and said, "Son, do you know God's love reaches as far as we can see in that direction?" He turned and said, "God's love is reaching as far as we can see in that direction. The whole way around us is God's love. As far as we can see and as far as we can think is God's love." And the little boy looked up at his daddy and said, "Wow, Daddy, we're right in the middle of it." So no matter if it's cancer, no matter if we are faced with trials, temptations, if we're in the middle of China serving, if we're right here at serving, we can be assured we are in the center of his love, and that's a wonderful place to be. Daniel chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, unto all the people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore made I a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known unto me the interpretation of the dream. Then came in the magicians, the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers, and I told the dream before them, but they did not make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But at the last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And before him I told the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my dream that I have seen, and the interpretation thereof. Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and it was meat for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, Hew down the tree and cut off its branches, shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof. Forasmuch as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies. The tree that thou sawest which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and an holy one coming down from heaven and saying, Hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king, that they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with wild beasts, with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Let's humbly kneel before our God in prayer.
Thank Brother Dwayne for his prayer on our behalf, as well as each of you, as you've been praying for the speaker of the evening. As we look at Daniel chapter 4 this evening, I would number of titles that you could give this chapter, perhaps the humiliation of a great proud king, or maybe the conversion of a proud king, or I guess we'll go with God opposeth the proud. During a televised speech, professional golfer Tiger Woods apologized for extramarital affairs that gained worldwide attention, garnered negative publicity, and cost him millions of dollars in commercial sponsorships. The words of Woods illustrated how pride and a sense of entitlement and an inflated ego had ruled his life. He said this, I knew my actions were wrong, but I convinced myself that normal rules did not apply. I never thought about who I was hurting. I thought I could get away with whatever I wanted to. I felt that I had worked hard my entire life and deserved to enjoy all the temptations around me. I felt I was entitled. Thanks to money and fame, I didn't have to go far to find them. I was wrong. I was foolish. I don't get to play by different rules. The same boundaries that apply to everyone apply to me. I brought this shame on myself. Another occurrence took place in a different setting. It was before a T-ball playoff game, and if you're not familiar with what T-ball is, that's simply baseball, or a soft form of baseball that's played by youngsters, maybe in the 8-9-year-old category. But it was a T-ball playoff game, and a coach of one of those teams offered to pay one of his players $25 if he hit a teammate on purpose with a thrown ball. The intended target was Harry, a 9-year-old who was mildly retarded. The goal was to avoid having to play Harry in the 3 innings required by league rules. Participation by the mildly retarded child would naturally decrease the team's chances for success. If Harry were hurt, he would most likely go home. When hitting Harry in the groin failed to have the desired effect, the coach asked the player to hit hard, or Harry harder with a second throw. The child hit Harry in the side of his face and ear, drawing blood. And traumatized, Harry did not play in the game. Pride and an untamed ego had caused a coach to do the unthinkable. It's been said that pride is perhaps the most destructive word in any language. When we realize that pride is the root of all sin, we see that it not only hurts others, but it also hurts the one within whom pride is operating. Proverbs tells us a lot about pride, and it speaks of the results of pride. Proverbs 16:18 says, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." Proverbs 29:23 says, "A man's pride shall bring him low." And then Proverbs 11:2 says, "When pride comes, then comes shame." And from the Proverbs, we also can see how God views pride. Proverbs 21:4 says, "An high look and a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked is sin." It's how God views it. Proverbs 16:5, "Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord." And Proverbs 8:13, "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogancy, an evil way, and the froward mouth do I hate." And then over in the New Testament, just one verse, but a very important verse that we can see and notice or God's view on pride is James 4, verse 6, where we read that God resisteth or opposeth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. Now it can be said that God fights against the proud. When we think of that word opposeth or resisteth, it's as if God is fighting against the proud, but he gives grace to help or helped to the humble. Pride is a serious sin. It condemns Satan and his angels. It leads to destruction. It brings one down, and it brings one shame. And we may see, or maybe we think, how awful others are, like the two that I referred to in the beginning, with their untamed egos and their blatant pride. But do we really or truly see our own lives? We may easily see pride in someone else, but not so easily or not so quickly see it in ourselves. Isn't it true that we also deal with inflated egos at times? And pride has so many ways of rearing its ugliness in our lives, sometimes ways that just sneak up on us, and maybe we don't even realize it until after the fact. Sometimes not even then until we need someone to come along and show us and say, "Do you realize your attitude there?" We even can get pretty good at acting and sounding humble because we know the right words. We know the right things to say. We know the right ways to act when in front of people. But in reality, pride can be a very real issue in our lives. Consider these evidences of pride in one's life. And here's 10, and this is certainly not an all-inclusive list, but it should make us think and of our own lives. Not admitting one's faults, but quick to blame others. Evidence of pride in my life. Not willing to change and always thinking that I'm right. Not being teachable or open to genuine instruction. Trying to prove others wrong, oftentimes for no reason at all. Or hoping that others fail so I look better and I'm exalted. These are all evidences of if those are feelings or something we're dealing with or at some point have or in the future, it's an evidence that there's pride in our heart. Another is comparing oneself to other people's abilities or skills or physical appearance or spiritual life. Doing things or saying things to make myself look better to others. Another form of pride in my life is not submitting to authority. I know better than they do. Who are they to tell me what I have to do? Another is desiring to be noticed. Oh, we may not act like it. We know, again, we know the right way to act. But deep within, there might be that desire to be noticed. And then a tenth one, quick to point out someone else's sin, but then usually not the first to reconcile with someone else. Why is it so hard sometimes to say, I'm sorry, or I was wrong? When you think about that, and the reason that it's so hard, really, it goes back to something within us called pride. J. Osborne Sanders said this, and I quote, "Nothing is more distasteful to God than self-conceit. This first and fundamental sin, in essence, aims at enthroning self at the expense of God. Pride is the sin of whose presence its victim is least conscious. If we are honest, when we measure ourselves by the life of our Lord who humbled himself even to the death on the cross, we cannot but be overwhelmed with the tawdriness and shabbiness and even the vileness of our hearts," end quote. I think he's right. You know, at times we hear sins being confessed, or we confess openly a sin. Yet how often does somebody publicly say, I confess the sin of pride? Could it be that we're too proud to admit it? Jonathan Edwards said, and I quote, "Pride is the worst viper that is in the heart, the greatest disturber of the soul's peace and sweet communion with Christ. It is the most difficult sin to root out, and the most hidden, secret, and deceitful of all lusts," end quote. Again, I think he's right. Pride is a serious sin that God hates. The essence of pride, to make it simple, is that it places self above God. It places self above God. When we do something that God says we shouldn't, or when we don't do something that God says we should, we are so saying that we know better than God. We're going to do what we want. He doesn't know what he's talking about because I know better, and I don't care what he says. I'm going to do what I want to do. And when we do that, we're placing ourselves above him. When we exalt ourselves or we take credit that is not rightfully ours, we place ourselves above God. God opposes the proud, but he'll give grace to the humble. The truth of those words that are found in James 4:6 are clearly illustrated in Daniel chapter 4. If you wanted to describe what takes place in this chapter with one verse, I believe it would be James 4:6, that God opposeth or resisteth the proud, but he gives grace to the humble, because you'll see that played out right before our eyes in that chapter. Daniel 4 is really the personal testimony of King Nebuchadnezzar. He's telling his story, and he wants all the world to know it. And I'm going to reread some of the verses again. Dwayne did fine, but it's to get our thoughts right there. But the first verse, "Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you." Nebuchadnezzar was the great king of Babylon. He ruled all the world as he knew it. But he was a very proud man, and he wanted all the world to know what he had to say. He was so proud that in chapter 3 he had a 90-foot image made and set up that all the people were to fall down to worship. The image represented himself, his greatness, and it resulted was a result of Nebuchadnezzar's inflated ego. Yet God had also been at work revealing himself to Nebuchadnezzar. In chapter 1, we know these chapters fairly well, most of us, but it's where Daniel purposed in his heart not to be defile himself with the king's meat and the king's drink. And we know what happened with him and the three Hebrew children as they refused that. And they made the deal, so to speak, with and after so long, they were presented to the king. And Nebuchadnezzar, they were called in and brought in before Nebuchadnezzar. And it says in verse 19, the king communed with them and among them. And among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. So Nebuchadnezzar had a taste or had been introduced to the God of the Hebrews simply by the actions of these men. And then in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and none of his people could interpret it, but Daniel, by God's help, was able to interpret that dream. And in response to that, I wonder as many times I got to say his name tonight, how it's going to come out every time. You know, in my notes, I just write Neb. I thought it saved me from writing it out so much, but King Neb, maybe we could just say that, but Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, and in response to Daniel being able to interpret it, and the interpretation of it, Nebuchadnezzar made this declaration in chapter 2, in verse 27, he said, and the princess, I'm sorry, I got the wrong chapter, the king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is, that your God is a God of gods, and a Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal this secret. How God is revealing himself to Nebuchadnezzar. And then in chapter 3, after the miracle of the three men not burning in the furnace, coming out of the furnace and not even smelling like smoke. And he called them the servants of the Most High God. And then he said this about God in verses 28 and verses 29 of chapter 3. He said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word and yielded their bodies that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. And their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other God that can deliver after this sort. This was Nebuchadnezzar being introduced to the real, true God. God was at work. Still, after all that, Nebuchadnezzar did not have a life-changing conversion to the God of heaven. He still hadn't had it. And at the close of chapter 3 until the happenings of chapter 4, it's believed that there would have been 25 to 30 years that passed. As we begin reading chapter 4, and Nebuchadnezzar is telling his story, and he wants all the world to know, and still it would appear or seems that something is different with Nebuchadnezzar as he's giving this testimony or he's telling his story. Listen as he speaks in verses 2 and 3, I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. Signs and wonders mean miracles. Nebuchadnezzar had seen enough miracles from God that he was ready to share with all the world his testimony about how God had worked. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. Something seems different about Nebuchadnezzar. And then beginning in verse 4, he goes on, or he starts to tell how this change came in his life. Verse 4 says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. Rest means he was secure. Flourishing means prosperous. In other words, things were good for Nebuchadnezzar. Things were going real good. But he had another troubling dream. This is at least the second one. It's the second one in Scripture. Once again, the king gave his people a chance to interpret, and one would wonder why he even gave them an opportunity this time. They couldn't do it the first time, but yet he does, and they still couldn't succeed. So Daniel again comes in, and he interprets a dream for King Nebuchadnezzar. And we'll jump to verses 8, where it says, "But alas, Daniel came in before me, whose name is Belshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And before him I told the dream, saying, O Belshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee. Tell me the visions of my dream that I've seen, and the interpretation thereof." Notice the word there, holy gods. King Nebuchadnezzar is saying to Daniel, I know that you have the spirit of the holy gods within you. That's the first time that Nebuchadnezzar refers to Daniel's God as holy. How did Nebuchadnezzar come to that understanding? How did he come to the place where he didn't call get the God of Daniel holy before, but now he is? When all those years that passed, don't you think Daniel and him had some conversations about the holy God that Daniel served? And no doubt Nebuchadnezzar had seen, not only had heard some words, but he saw how Daniel lived. And his way of living pointed to the holiness of God, the God that Daniel worshiped. John MacArthur says this, and I quote, "A man worships a God, and that worship will reflect what he believes that God to be." Unquote. Think about that. A man worships a God, and that worship will reflect what he believes that God to be. Daniel's life surely reflected what he believed God to be, holy, and no doubt the king saw it. And he says, I know within you is the spirit of the holy gods. Nebuchadnezzar's dream was about a tree. You notice in those verses, it's a tree that grew huge. I mean, a huge tree. It was a provider to all. According to verse 12, it says, "The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. And the beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it." But then an angel came and said that the tree should be cut down. It all was to come crashing down. In verses 14 to 15, it says, "He cried aloud and said, Thus, hew down the tree and cut off his branches, shake off his leaves and scatter his fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass and the tender grass of the field. And let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts and the grass of the earth." I thought we're talking about a tree. Why is he saying his? Tree is being referred to in the male gender. Well, the tree represented Nebuchadnezzar, obviously, and we know that, as Daniel would tell him in verse 22. He goes on in verse 16, "Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him, and let seven times pass over him." His heart would be changed. Or his thinking, his mind would be changed from a man's to that like an animal. Boanthropy, I believe, is the word for it. There have actually been, I read about an actual case in the 1940s, similar to what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 17 says, "This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand," or the angels, "and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of man, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of man." In the end of his dream, the reason was given for why these things would take place, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of man, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis, or lowest of men. That's the key to the chapter. That ending to that verse. This is the message of Daniel 4. All need to learn that the Most High God rules the kingdom of men. That's the message of Daniel 4. That's what Nebuchadnezzar needed to learn. Well, now Daniel needed to interpret the dream for the king. And notice in verse 19, it says, "Then Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belshazzar answered and said, My lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies." Now listen, Nebuchadnezzar was not the nicest man on the earth. He was known to be a murderous king, a merciless king. But something had happened between him and Daniel. There was a closeness, and Daniel cared for him. Daniel says, "I wish what I'm about to say would be for your enemies instead of you." I don't know. There's a lesson there for us. When we look at people that we think we should, maybe that we can't witness to, or that there's no hope for them, or they just rub us the wrong way and we don't think we can witness to them, or maybe it's the way we witness to them. How about if we have a care for them like Daniel did? Not that we're anxious to tell them, here's what's going to happen to you if you don't repent, come to the Lord. But I got to tell you because I care for you. He goes on to tell King Nebuchadnezzar that he was the tree and that the decree of the Most High was this. In verse 25, he says, "That they shall drive thee from men, and that thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over thee." That means 7 years. "Till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will." Notice again, the end of that verse, "till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and give it to whomsoever he will." Nebuchadnezzar had to learn who deserved the credit, and that all that the king had was because God had given it to him. God will not tolerate anyone placing themselves above him. Isaiah 42:8 says, "I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images." God does not want to give up his glory to someone else. Later on in chapter 48 of Isaiah, verse 11, again it emphasizes this thought, "For mine own self," God speaking, "even for mine own sake will I do it. For how should my name polluted? And I will not give my glory unto another." God's not in the business of giving his glory that he deserves over to man. It's his alone. He will not tolerate anyone placing themselves above him. Every leader since Nebuchadnezzar needs to learn the same lesson that Nebuchadnezzar was needing to learn here, that God rules the kingdom of men. He deserves the praise and the glory for what he has given. It's also a lesson that every one of us as individuals needs to learn as well. It's not for us to take pride in anything good that's in our lives, as it being for our own glory, but it's only a result of what God has done through me or in my life. If something good is there, it's only because of God. Ultimately, he has to have the glory. He's the one that deserves the praise. Once Nebuchadnezzar learned this lesson, his kingdom would be given back to him, according to verse 26. "And whereas they commanded to lead the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee. After that thou shalt have known that the heavens do roll." The idea there of the stump and the roots being left there meant that Nebuchadnezzar would be left alive. And as soon as he learned that the heavens roar, that God rules in the kingdom of men, his kingdom would be returned to him. It would be kept safe. And then in verse 27, Daniel pleads with the king to repent. He says, "Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. Perhaps God will not bring this upon you if you'll only get right with him. Notice he says, if you'll break off thy sins by righteousness, get right with God. And then what was he supposed to do? Change his behavior and be merciful and do good to those around him. Oh, he didn't repent. So he dropped down to verse 28, says, all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 29, it says, at the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. 1 year passed by. God gave him 1 year. Even after everything that had taken place, God still gave him 1 year to repent. But he refused. Notice his pride. Verse 30, the king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? You know, Babylon was quite an amazing place. It was 15 square miles, actually in a square, 200,000 people or so. Wide streets and strong fortifications, sufficient land for farming and pasture, and it was surrounded by a deep and wide moat that was filled with water and a wall that was 87 feet wide. They said you could drive four chariots, four abreast, on the top of that wall. And it stood, how high do you think that wall stood? 350 feet high. The Euphrates River ran right through the city. It's quite a secure place. This was the great, he had a place constructed or a place made for his wife called the Hanging Gardens, and it had an effect where it was like air conditioning. In that time, the way he had it set up, he was an amazing man, and he said, look at all this that's mine. God said, that's enough. He said, that's enough. Verse 31, while the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth. Till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Verse 33 tells us that the great King Nebuchadnezzar became like an animal for 7 years. He grew feathers. His fingers became like claws. He was fenced in. And it talks back when it talks about the stump being a band of iron and so around it, I believe that's referring to some kind of a fence that he would be inside and kept in, and he would be protected. God was overseeing all this. Can you imagine? That's like the president of the United States all of a sudden turning into an animal, and he's out in front of the White House, fenced in the, running around in the grass like an animal. That's what happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. What a humiliation. God opposes the proud. He made it very clear. By the end of 7 years, Nebuchadnezzar had learned the lesson that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men. I'm going to read the last verses of that chapter, starting at verse 34. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High. And I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? At the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lord sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, he doesn't no longer praise himself. Listen what he says. He says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase or to bring low. He had learned the lesson. And God also gives grace to the humble. He experienced that. His kingdom was given back to him. But now he knew where it came from and whom deserved the glory and the praise. And further emphasized, I believe, that God is the one who establishes kingdom and he gives them to whomsoever he will. Wasn't it even part of this marvelous plan that he protected that kingdom or that throne for Nebuchadnezzar? You would have thought someone would have tried to take over the throne in 7 years' time. But God says, no, it'll be there. It's secure. Once you learn the lesson. God gave honor back to Nebuchadnezzar now that he realized his rightful place. In 1 Samuel 2:30, God is saying this, and he says, for them that honor me, I will honor. You know, that's not just a saying for that verse. That's an aspect of God that holds true throughout the ages. Those who honor God, he will honor. He does the same today. He'll give honor to people who are humble and don't take the glory that belongs to God. They recognize where their goodness or all that's good that's coming out of their life or that's coming from, or all that they have. They recognize where it's coming to them, but he'll give them the honor that's due them then because they recognize their place underneath God. And he's the one that deserves the praise and the glory. Was Nebuchadnezzar finally converted here? I believe there's reason to think he was. You can draw your own conclusions, but can you imagine meeting Nebuchadnezzar in heaven? Getting a group of Nebuchadnezzar and the three Hebrew children together, and you want to tell me about that fiery furnace incident? I'd like to hear an actual account from you who were there. I don't know what all took place. Nebuchadnezzar, in the final, till his life ended. But I believe that we could say that he was converted here. Notice the last words of Nebuchadnezzar's testimony. He says, those that walk in pride, he is able to abase. Who better could say that? Who better could say that? You think about that, Nebuchadnezzar could go up to someone and he could say, you know what? Listen to me. Listen to me. I'm going to tell you. That if you walk in pride, God's going to bring you low. They're going to say, well, do you know what you're talking about? And he said, yeah, I experienced 7 years of it. I sure do. God will bring down the proud. He opposes them, but he gives grace to the humble. He gives grace to the humble. I ask you this evening, do you need grace? I need it. I need grace to save me. Yeah, not just doesn't stop there. I need ongoing grace in my life. If I don't have the grace of God in my life's going to be miserable. It's going to be terrible. And I'll have to face things without the wonderful grace of God being poured out on my life. And so will you. We need grace. The way to get it, God gives it to the humble. He gives it to the humble. Jeremiah 9:23 and 24 in closing says this. Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his mighty, or in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, meaning God, that I am the Lord which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth, for in these things I delight, saith the Lord. He wants humble people. God help us. God help us to be those kind of people.
It's interesting that the ninth letter of our alphabet is the center letter of the word pride. Five words might help us caution the meaning of that word that our brother brought to us tonight. Purposefully review inward desires earnestly. Would you stand with us for prayer?